Thomas Jefferson said that whenever there are unemployed poor, it is clear that the laws of property have been so far extended as to violate natural right. It was Jefferson's view that it was the duty of government to promote the general well-being of the nation by doing those things that individuals could not do. Today in America, whole classes of people are disempowered and systematically impeded in their search for employment. One might well conclude with Thomas Jefferson that the laws of property have been overextended and that natural rights have been violated. One might well conclude, but it is also a national debate. How much should government do to promote the general well-being, and what are the things it should do that individuals cannot do for themselves? I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC-FM. Today on Sunday at Noon, our discussion focuses on affirmative action and the ongoing debate over its implementation. I have three guests in studio with me today. I'm pleased to welcome Joe Cooper, who is president of J. Cooper & Associates, a Washington, D.C. consulting firm. The firm specializes in the area of equal employment opportunity and affirmative action. Mr. Cooper was also director of the Office of Federal Compliance Programs for several years in the U.S. Department of Labor, and he has served the Bush administration, Nixon, he served the Ford administration, the Nixon administration, and the Reagan administration in that capacity. Dick Baldo is retired. He is the former training coordinator and chief of the planning and support section of the Office of Federal Compliance Programs in the U.S. Department of Labor. And also with us is Gary Cunningham, current deputy director of Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. These gentlemen all come with a great number of skills and much expertise in their fields. I'll do my best as we go on through our hour to make note of it. It may be odd to begin an hour with a comment by Thomas Jefferson. He is a man whose first memory was being carried on a silk cushion by a black slave on his plantation. He agonized over what he called the problem of slavery, and yet never freed the people he owned through his lifetime. And yet, this father of our democracy held many forward thoughts. So the irony is there, I suppose, to be looked at in the next hour. I'd like to begin, if we can, by looking at some of the history of affirmative action. How did this evolve in our country? Dick, you mentioned before we started that you have a great length, 25 years of federal experience to contribute. And the first mention of affirmative action, although not in those two words, was during the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration. Is that right?
That's right, Susan. President Roosevelt, during the Second World War, signed several executive orders that dealt with the defense industry at that point. The words affirmative action didn't come in until the 1960s, when President Kennedy was in office and an executive order was promulgated that created an agency that reported directly to President Kennedy. In that executive order, the words affirmative action were used, although they weren't defined very clearly. Then President Johnson in 1965 issued the current executive order, 11246, that deals with federal contractors. Actually, the order had three parts. One dealt with federal employment, and the a third part dealt with awards that were supposed to go to companies that practiced equal employment opportunity. The third part, and the one that is most well known, deals with federal contractors and requires that they take affirmative action and that they do not discriminate against people because of their race, creed, color, and national origin. A year or two later, another executive order was signed by President Johnson, which extended the initial executive order to sex. And so when we speak of the executive order 11246, which is in power today, we include sex, even though a separate executive order was signed to deal with that. And then in 1973, the Congress passed the Rehabilitation Act, and one section of that deals with employment by government contractors and requires them to take affirmative action. A year later, the Congress passed the Vietnam-era Veterans Readjustment Assistance Act and required that federal contractors take affirmative action with respect to Vietnam-era veterans and some classes of disabled veterans. So that's where we are today on the federal level.
Okay, and that's the legal history of it.
Yeah.
Joe Cooper, I want to take a look at different perspectives on affirmative action at the time that these acts were passed and came into power. These were not received with open arms, were they?
Well, I don't think in certain circles, certainly it was not. I think some of the initial reaction was clearly political. I think some leaders in government and also the Congress, and I'm talking specifically now to Congress, felt that there was a need to make certain that certain members of our society, the population, shared in the various types of opportunities that existed for people doing business with the government and also within the government itself. Overall, I think initially there was a great deal of controversy, but by and large, as time went on, corporate America and also the government accepted to a large degree the concept of affirmative action. And as we get further on into, I think, the years ahead, you'll see a great deal more acceptance, primarily because of the changing labor force.
Gary Cunningham, again, you're the Deputy Director of the Department of Civil Rights for the City of Minneapolis. Do you see a comfortable acceptance with the notion of affirmative action, either in years past as we began in the year 1965 or coming up through now?
Well, I take a little different philosophical approach to the history of affirmative action than just the strict legal history that's been recited here. What I go back to has to do with your original statement about Thomas Jefferson and the Constitution. At the time that the Constitution was written, black people, African-American people, were considered three-fifths of a human being. American Indian people, Native people here, weren't even considered human beings under that document. The issue that I'm trying to raise here is that after the Civil War, they came up with the Civil Rights Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Those amendments basically were designed to provide equal protection under the law as well as other rights to African-American citizens, former slaves, freedmen, if you will, to participate in the society as equals. Also, there was a commitment made by the federal government through the Congress at that time to provide restitution to those people that had suffered under slavery as a part of the Reconstruction Act. There was a promise of 40 acres and a mule to black families that were slaves. That promise was never fulfilled, nor was the promise of treaty rights to Native people in this country, both in Alaska and in the lower 48 states. And my concept of affirmative action basically has to do with a more societal kind of thing in terms of providing some type of program to allow people that have been historically discriminated against to participate as equals in job opportunities and other opportunities in this country. And so my basis of affirmative action is if they would have given African Americans their 40 acres of mew back in Reconstruction, there would be no need for affirmative action today because it would change the economic character of the communities of color, particularly the African American community, where we would be owners instead of being owned. We would be producers instead of being consumers. That's the fundamental thrust, I think, that came into play in the 40s was this continued economic and political and social disparities that people of color were suffering from. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt attempted to address these, not on his own, but from pressure from communities of color at that time, A. Philip Randolph and the sleeping car porters, other groups in the 40s, placed pressure on the federal government to treat citizens of color as equals in the society. And one way to do that, of course, is through an affirmative program to address and to bring up to parity people of color and to provide them with those economic opportunities that they need. So my definition and the history that I bring up is a little different. With regards to your question, how is it perceived? In Minneapolis, it has general acceptance in terms of the political, those people, the policymakers, accept affirmative action and have strong laws on record to support it. I come from a city that was the home of Hubert Humphrey. He's the former mayor as well as vice president, as well as one of the authors of Title VII in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Also, Mayor Don Frazier also was one of the authors and was a congressman, the current mayor of Minneapolis. So I come from a place where affirmative action and equal opportunity is valued highly. The business community, for the most part, the larger corporations have come to accept affirmative action on a number of different levels, both from an economic standpoint and seen as Joe had mentioned and as yourself have mentioned, that the workforce is definitely changing, but also the fact that they want to be perceived as being fair and equitable in the marketplace, because that's what the basic tendencies and the basic philosophy of America is, that we're all equal. And so that's important to them. The vast majority of contractors, I think, do, in fact, implement their affirmative action plans, but there's a few that give the others a bad name.
I would like to say, at least for myself, I've always felt that since the 60s, actually, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which covered employment in one section, it covered public accommodations in another, on the federal level, and the different state agencies that have grown up. I think New York was the first in the late 40s or early 50s. I know from my own experience, the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, the Cleveland, Ohio Fair Employment Practices Commission that started in the 40s. Even with all of this, I've always felt that the country may have made a legal decision for equal opportunity in all of its ramifications, but I don't yet think we've made the political decision to fulfill that.
Actually, I want to look at that. There are, and Gary, you brought it up by bringing up a philosophical context for affirmative action. There are a number of philosophical, social, and legal arguments against affirmative action. People say that it is reverse discrimination to try to right wrongs done to people, so-called, in history. And you shouldn't take away rights of people today to give rights to other people. People say that you can't redress individual wrongs by providing group solutions. Can you help us, me and our listeners, take a look at some of the objections to affirmative action and respond to them? And I open it to any. Joe Cooper, do you want to start?
Well, clearly, to some degree, there are those when you impose any type of an affirmative action policy who will argue that you are taking away the rights of some for the benefits of others. I think, however, you can spend a great deal of time talking about philosophical concepts and what has taken place over the years and the reasons for members of the protected groups to participate in our society. The bottom line is that affirmative action works, and affirmative action is needed because there are those who still believe that we live in a colorblind society when in reality we do not. We live in a society where there is a great deal of discrimination, And it does not just simply limit itself to people of color. I mean, you have religious discrimination, you have gender discrimination. If you look at affirmative action and if you look at companies that are supporting affirmative action, you have to look at a much broader picture. And what you have to look at is competition in business, because basically that's what it boils down to. The realities are the workforce is changing. By the year 2000, you will have more people of color in America. As a result of that, that's the bulk of your labor force. The realities are that of those people, you are limited in terms of how many of them are actually qualified to meet the needs of many of the companies that exist. They have to do something about that, and they have to begin to look at these people and devise ways to bring them into the workforce. So I don't think you'll be finding a great deal of discussions. I mean, certainly within the last 10 years, you've had a lot of discussions about reverse discrimination. In some of the most recent Supreme Court cases, you've had some discussions brought up in terms of whites in Martin versus Wilkes, the firefighters in Alabama, where they talked in terms of not being a part of a consent decree and they were experiencing reverse discrimination. The Supreme Court handed down a very narrow decision in that particular case, basically stating that the white firefighters had an opportunity to come back even though a consent decree was in place. They could come back, reopen it, and become part of it. Even though that is the case, in that particular Supreme Court decision, the fact still nevertheless remains that corporate America is looking at it from a completely different standpoint. And that standpoint is that we want to be competitive with the rest of the world, and in order to do that, we must devise ways to work with minorities and women. So I think the thing that will be driving affirmative action is economics. And I think if you look back throughout history, we've talked a little about Roosevelt and one president. I think we tend to forget or we overlook a great deal when we think in terms of affirmative action, and that's Truman. It was Truman who integrated the military. It was not Roosevelt. And Roosevelt signed his initial orders as a direct result and pressure from his wife. It was not a feeling on his part to do something nice. It was a direct pressure from his wife and her relationship with A. Philip Randolph. But I guess what I'm saying to you is that we can talk a lot about the philosophical approach, but the bottom line is the thing that drives affirmative action, or will be in the foreseeable future, is competition. And the bottom line is when you talk about that, you're talking about profits, dollars and cents.
And yet I'd like to make a point here.
Dick Paldo.
Most chambers of commerce oppose the idea of federally funded in almost any form, child care. And yet child care, it seems to me, is a form of affirmative action to allow women to get into the workplace. And it's just incredible to me that there are still organizations out there that say business should not pay for or do anything in some of these areas. And yet there are some businesses that do quite a bit.
It may well be underscoring the thought that prejudice fully exists in this society and is ongoing. And one of the prejudices is the appropriate place for a woman is in the home.
Well, let me just say this. I think prejudice will always be with us, particularly when you're looking at the different cultural groups that's building up in America now. You have the blacks, the Asians, the Hispanics, the Vietnamese, and all of the various different cultural groups. That will always be with us. The key factor is going to be, the day is going to come when affirmative action, candidly, will no longer be needed. And that's going to be a direct result of the fact that companies must be competitive. By the year 1992, Europe will virtually, for all practical purposes, be another America, because they will be tearing down their border restrictions in terms of trade. As that takes place, that means that we will have to be more competitive in terms of how we do business overseas and vice versa. That's an area that if you are a smart businessman and if you are concerned about survival, you're going to be looking at those resources that will help you be competitive, and you will no longer have the time to be concerned about whether or not a woman is capable of doing a job or a black or an Asian or a Hispanic. You're going to be looking for the best qualified person, and that's really what affirmative action is all about. It's finding the best qualified person to bring into the system.
Your contention is that if we don't pull together a working affirmative action program for this entire nation that will bring disenfranchised, so to speak, people into the workforce and educate them to do the technical jobs that are appearing more and more, that the large companies will simply go away. They will go to Europe, they will go to Asia.
I think a lot of them are doing that in some instances now, but yes, I think, and that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about companies, and that's where people benefit in affirmative action. I think you will find a lot of the companies trying to devise other ways, and they will move elsewhere. I don't see smart companies who are aware of the problem that exists today continuing in this vein as, let's say, 25, 30 years ago. Now, bear in mind, I'm not saying discrimination does not exist. It does, and it will probably be with us, as I indicated, for a long time in the future. What I'm saying is that businessmen, smart businessmen in smart companies, in successful companies, will be looking at other means to resolve the problems, and they will not be concerned as much as some companies today and 20 and 30 years ago about the issue of whether or not a person is black, Hispanic, etc.
Let me take a minute to reintroduce each of you to the audience, and then Gary Cunningham, I'd like to turn to you for your thoughts on what these two have been saying. Joe Cooper is currently the president of his company, J. Cooper & Associates. It's a Washington, D.C. consulting firm specializing in the areas of equal employment opportunity and affirmative action. He is formerly the director of the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, also formerly from that office, now retired, the training coordinator and chief of the planning and support section of the Office of Federal Compliance Programs in the U.S. Department of Labor. That's Richard Baldo. And with us also Gary Cunningham, deputy director of the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights. In that job, he manages the contract compliance intake first-tier case investigation units. He is formerly a consultant to the Office of Housing and Urban Development. Gary Cunningham, your thoughts on what has just been said?
I'd like to back it up just a bit. I think the audience may like to know, because there's a lot of misconception about what affirmative action is and what it is not. And I guess one of the things that I, interacting with 700 or 800 companies per year, that I get a lot is companies coming in and saying, oh, if I practice affirmative action, it's going to be reverse discrimination, or you know, what is this preferential treatment? All those kind of questions that come up. And I guess what I do is I compare it to an acceptable preference program, which is preference for residents for college, for example. The University of Alaska may have a preference for residents over preference for non-residents, or a veterans preference program that came in basically after World War I and World War II. Veterans, because of their service to the country, received preference in government jobs based upon that. And people are able to understand and address those kind of programs, but when it comes to taking some preference to address underutilization in a job classification, people have a problem with that. And the problem is a procedural problem, a perceived problem of procedural fairness. From the point of view of the employer that's worked in the company for 10 years, for example, they see somebody making a decision in part based upon someone's race because they don't have any persons of color or any females in a job, they see that as a step over to them. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem in addressing affirmative action programs, is that in order for the program to be effective, the top officials within that organization have to make it clear that they are not taking steps to over or trample, as the court would say, trample on the rights of those individuals already in those job classifications or in the job. There's no, the law, you can't lay somebody off or fire somebody to take affirmative action. That's a misnomer, and that's something that people don't seem to understand. They think, take affirmative action, I've got to come in and fire all my white workers and hire minority workers. That's not the case. What the law provides is that affirmative action plans should be narrowly tailored, that they should be designed to address the problem that the company has recognized, where they have in the past had opportunities to hire people of color and women, have not, therefore they have an underutilization is what we call it. It's a technical term for it. They're not represented in that job group at the level that they would be in the labor force, for example. There's so many minority carpenters available, but yet our company doesn't have any. Why is that? And what can we do to correct that? That's what the affirmative action program's all about. So at the time when you have hiring opportunities and you have qualified minority applicants apply, that because your company in the past has not taken action to address that problem, and because your company should be reflective of the community at large and the workers in the labor force, that you take that action to ensure that you have a multicultural, gender-based workforce so that everybody in your company has an equal opportunity. That program, and the program that I'm talking about, narrowly tailored program that addresses underutilization, is what we're talking about, or at least what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. when I say taking affirmative action. I just want to clear that up,
sure.
because I wanted to clear up some of the misconceptions, because what I find in dealing with a lot of these companies is once they are educated and understand what the principles involved here are, they are less resistant to taking that action that is needed.
There was a major case in the 70s, and someone in this room besides me can flesh it out for us, but Kaiser Aluminum had a number of workers, of black workers in their company, but only 2% in upper management. They could develop a training program to move people up. A gentleman named Weber noticed that black men with, I think, two black men with less seniority than he had gotten into the training program, and he didn't. And he went to the court, ultimately to the Supreme Court, to say, this isn't fair. The court decided, if I'm right, that it was fair, that we are changing a wrong into a right here.
Well, I think that the narrow issue in that particular decision that the court found in for the company was that this was not a required program. This was a voluntary affirmative action that Kaiser took. And so they were okay in doing it, in making some choices to address what they saw as a problem, i.e., blacks had not gotten into the training programs that the company had set up. The very narrow legal issue there was that it was a voluntary program rather than a required government program.
Right. There was another internationally known case before the Supreme Court in the 70s. Mr. Bakke decided that he had been unfairly excluded from University of California Medical School, and it was determined again that he was fairly excluded, although that was a fairly narrow decision, if I remember.
Mr. Bakke was determined that Mr. Bakke was excluded unfairly.
Unfairly.
Yeah, that in fact what the court had decided is that while affirmative action programs are permissible, the program established by the University of California, Davis, was impermissible in that it set up a rigid quota system wherein the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, where everyone is theoretically supposed to be treated equally, was violated in that it provided an exclusive program just for minorities at the expense of white applicants for those positions. But they did uphold affirmative action within that decision. The public kind of media program around that case seemed to indicate that the court had said no to affirmative action, and in fact that was indeed not the case. What it did was set up some specific guidelines, unclear at times, but set up some specific guidelines. The narrowly tailored portion that I had already talked about, the flexibility instead of having quotas, a goal-driven program, which is a big difference between saying that I'm going to set aside 10% of my job specifically for blacks. I'm not going to exceed that. I'm not going to go under that at the expense of qualified white applicants. Basically, what you set up is a system that has no flexibility and allows for you to make those decisions based upon qualifications and using race as only a factor in that decision.
I think just to pick up on both what Dick and Gary has been talking about, you've had some overzealous individuals in regulatory agencies responsible for affirmative action that both in the Democratic administration of Jimmy Carter and also the Reagan administration. And they've sent out some really confusing signals, and it has created more problems in terms of perception as to what affirmative action is all about and what it truly means. And as a result of that, you've had a lot of problems with people accepting affirmative action. You've had that in the case with the Reagan administration. Certainly when they were talking about quotas versus goals. Affirmative action is predicated on meeting goals, not quotas. But you did have within the Department of Justice some real concerns there where they thought goals were quotas and they were not. You have had the courts rule in certain cases, particularly in construction cases, where they have to use quotas because of the egregious form of discrimination that has taken place. Philadelphia.
We just had an exchange of eyes here for those who can't see into your radio.
It was in some cases in Philadelphia. But I can get to it. But the fact of the matter is courts have in certain cases imposed quotas, and they have also imposed certain types of consent decrees where egregious discrimination has existed.
You've mentioned consent decree before. Can you tell people what a consent decree is?
That's basically, I think I'll let Dick answer that one, but basically it's where there is the courts set up some guidelines as to what a company or a contractor, some things that they must do in order to meet what they perceive the procedures to do what was wrong within an operation.
I think that a consent decree can be defined as a decree where both sides agree and the court really is the referee of the decree. It is different in that both sides agree that this is what we're going to do rather than the court imposing it as the result of a finding. Mm-hmm. And I did want to say something to Joe's statement about quotas. I don't know of a court that has imposed a quota. I do know that they have imposed goals of, say, 2-for-1 in a lot of police cases, and in some construction areas there have been pretty heavy goals imposed, but the test isn't did we meet that, but it was did we make a good faith effort to meet it, even though the goal was fairly high. Because of the egregiousness, as you pointed out, of the problem that preceded it.
Okay, what I'm talking about, and unfortunately I don't have the case, it was a construction case, union case in Philadelphia, in which the courts ruled that this particular union had discriminated so egregiously that they must go out and hire X number of minorities to X number of whites. Now, that's what you're saying, but basically that's a quota because mm-hmm. you're saying you must hire X number of people for every X whites you hire, you must hire X number of minorities. To me, while that may be a goal, that still is a very strong quota in that sense.
I still don't think it's a quota.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I could jump in just for a minute.
The
courts have issued quotas. In fact, in the city of Minneapolis, on the fire department, they issued a quota of 10 hiring in 1979 because there was such an egregious discriminatory act over a period of history where, in fact, the court had ordered goals and they continued not to to resist even hiring under a goal system. The court came in and said, yes, you're going to have to hire so many people of color in your next hiring, 10 people or whatever it was. I would like to say something also, how the Supreme Court basically has taken the position recently that there's very little difference between a quota in or a goal. Basically, their position has been that Croson, City of Richmond versus Croson, J.A. Croson, basically is that the City of Richmond had a set-aside program for minority businesses, and they had set a goal of 30% over a five-year period. In each contract let, 30% of that contract dollars would have to go to a minority firm. They had a waiver provision that deals with the good faith effort issue that Dick had brought up, that in fact, if a contractor could not get minority vendors or there were minority vendors were unwilling to participate in the contract, that indeed they could obtain a waiver. In the Croson case, Croson attempted to get a minority to bid on the job. The minority's bid, according to Croson, was too high and according to the court. And Croson attempted to get a waiver. City of Richmond rejected that waiver, providing him with a waiver. Went out for bids again, and he went to court. Lower court upheld it. The appellate court upheld the Richmond utilization plan. And then it went to the Supreme Court where it was struck down. And the court has now implemented what they call strict scrutiny on these type of affirmative action programs, the business minority business plans for local and state government. However, it's unclear at this time that those kind of standards may also apply to employment affirmative action programs as well in the future.
Actually, the Croson decision was perhaps one of the worst decisions to bring before the Supreme Court, in that the city had not done its homework well. I don't think anybody would like to see discrimination, even when it comes to minorities getting set-aside programs or having the opportunity to participate. But the fact of the matter is that that was one case that was not very well put together. In other words, the city had not effectively justify on paper why there was a need, even though there was a great deal of discrimination in the city of Richmond. And clearly there was a need for some type of set-aside program. What the courts basically said is you have to really be able to show that there is a need and document it. Let me just also mention one other thing, because I know Gary wants to jump in on that one. I believe it was a major airline in which the court basically set up a consent decree, and to my knowledge, I think that airline is still under that consent decree.
There are several airlines.
There are several, but it was a
so
major one.
Fly us home.
Yeah. Well, no, we don't mean that, because we're not on not any of the airlines we're flying on is involved.
Don't say that, Joe. Don't say that.
Let's move, if we can, from specifics to general. Joe Cooper, you've mentioned a couple of times that our workforce in this country is going to be changing radically from the way it, if not from the way it is, at least from the way we perceive it in the next 10, 20, and 30 years, and that change may well be permanent. If that is the case, and it looks to be, what is it that businesses and what is it that government and what is it that educational institutions need to do to make sure this country doesn't face ever more difficult times down the road? And again, I open this to
Well,
any?
If I, I'll start and then, but basically I think education is critical. There are a number of areas. The Labor Department back, I believe it was in 1980, issued a result of a study that was, they commissioned, I believe, the Hudson Institute to put together. It was called Workforce 2000. And it looked at seven major issues that impact the labor force: age, women, where we would be getting, how the job, the industries will be changing in America, et cetera. And the results was really quite shocking. First of all, it certainly indicated that there will be a change in the workforce, and that more and more of the workforce will be made up of women. In fact, approximately half of the workforce by the year 2000 will be made up of women, a large result of more and more women coming in, because you need two people in today's economy to work. So you have a lot of women coming into the workforce who's never been there before. You have a lot of single mothers in the workforce, and these are issues that companies must come to grips with. You have a great many, you have the Hispanic population, the Asian population, and the Black population growing, and they in turn will be a resource for this workforce. The problem is one of education. More and more white males, you're not able to replenish the white males into the workforce. For all practical purposes, within another, I believe, 50 years, you will have a minority. White males in this country will be a minority in America. So, I'm sorry.
Dick Bondo, you think it's less than 50 years?
Oh, yes, yeah. I think it's going to be in about 10 years.
Yeah.
When you're talking of the workforce, which is different than the general population.
And then, so the question really becomes, what do you do with this group of people? Because the educational system in this country has not really done a very good job in terms of training this new workforce to deal with the highly advanced technology that exists today. We as a country are becoming more and more of a service industry country as opposed to a manufacturing company. In fact, this same study indicated that over, I believe it's 40% of the new jobs that will be created by the year 2000 will be in service industry as opposed to manufacturing. So what that means is that you have to have more people who can think and more people who can rationalize in their heads as opposed to people who use muscles and other forms of working. But I would say that clearly what needs to be done is more attention given to our educational system. I think also corporate America needs to do more, and they will have to do more, and they are doing more now in terms of training people. And in the areas of retirement, they're not letting people retire as they used to. They're holding on to them. They are looking at their personnel policies, and they're making changes, too. I'm going to let these guys jump in.
If I could, I have a little different analysis of it. Being someone that monitors and enforces civil rights provision for the city of Minneapolis, my perception of it is all the things Jill said are correct in terms of the changing workforce. I think that the view of affirmative action, though, of solving these problems in and of itself is not going to happen. I think that the communities of color, the women's community, the disabled community, and those other communities that are under the protected class status have to also take it upon themselves to address some of the problems within their communities in order to be a part of and be an equal in the society as a whole. And what I mean when I say that is basically that affirmative action is only a Band-Aid. It's only a Band-Aid. It's not going to solve the problems of of the workforce in general. It can help and assist in that, but I think that also these communities, my community, the African American community, the Asian community, the Native community, et cetera, has to take some responsibility for educating our own people and addressing some of the internal problems that we have as a fallout from being disenfranchised for many years. So I think to look at affirmative action in and of itself as being a cure-all for equality and the issues that you brought up of Thomas Jefferson and egalitarian society, I think would be a misnomer for us to continue that perception. I think it's important for these communities to organize, to address some of the issues internally for themselves and work together instead of having the conflicts that we see between the various communities of color who have a vested interest in working together to address the ills of their community.
And even that is much easier said than done.
Oh, absolutely.
The Hispanic community in this country is by and large poor, not terribly well educated. The feminization of poverty is well known, that the poorest groups in America today are made up of women and children, and that will be increasing. Black people, many black people in the same situation.
Absolutely.
So when we call on ourselves to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, we have to, I suppose, be very aware that those bootstraps are a little weak.
No, that's not what I was saying, though. I think that's a different, I think you're saying pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. What I'm saying is that we need to organize and be political within our own community. Mm-hmm. I had heard Elizabeth Dole about 2 months ago. She came to Minneapolis and gave a speech, and she's a Republican. I happen not to be of that particular party. But she gave a great speech because what she was saying is that there's all kind of jobs. You go to the McDonald's in Minneapolis or any of these places, they've got jobs galore to offer, but nobody's taking them. Above minimum wage jobs. Nobody's taking those jobs. Nobody's working those jobs. There's plenty of jobs available in Minneapolis. I don't know what's going on here, but in Minneapolis, there's a lot of jobs available. Nobody's taking those jobs. And part of the reason is because some of the communities of color are not educating their communities or not the infrastructure of that community is so broken down. I'm not saying pulling yourselves up to be a middle class. I'm saying pulling yourselves up to be a community because there's so much divisiveness in those communities that it's difficult for us even to have our own culture and our own identity.
Dick Caldwell, interested in getting in here.
I wanted to just ask, Gary, you said that you heard Elizabeth Dole, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of McDonald's jobs opening up. Why then, I wonder, does she endorse the idea of a training wage, which I think is a ridiculous thing?
Well, I can't, mm-hmm. I can't try to justify her... her attitude or why she does that. I mean, as you know, during the Republican administration, we had the greatest setbacks for affirmative action in the history of affirmative action with the decision with all the justices appointed by the Reagan administration on the court that have a conservative viewpoint, as well as a cutback in funding to OFCCP and other enforcement agencies that cut them to the bare bones, the EEOC, in terms of enforcing their mandate. So the commitment by the Republicans in general and Mr. Reagan and Bush in particular is less than desirable.
Well, let me say this. I think clearly there has been a perception on the part of some in our country that the Republican Party has not supported affirmative action. I got to be in all fairness, I must say that's not totally true. In fact, there had been a tremendous, and I said totally true, there had been a...
We must understand the laughter in this room. We have two Democrats. The Speaker is a Republican, but the Speaker also left the Reagan administration in anger for the policies had not been being carried out.
It had been in not anger, but in terms of disagreement, in terms of policy.
Okay.
But I think it's important to point out that Shultz, the former Secretary of Defense as well as Labor, was a strong supporter of affirmative action, mm-hmm. and he did a lot in that area. And when there was a move on the part of some within the Reagan administration to do away with the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs and to do away with the set-aside programs, which I might add was created by a Republican Nixon administration, mm-hmm. There were many in the Reagan administration who supported leaving those programs in place. And I must say that if they did not give that support, those programs would not be in existence today. So I think if we want to deal with politics here, we have to be able to deal with the facts.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
All right. I want to get to one larger issue. So just a quick thing. Can someone give me an appraisal of where this nation is now as led by the Bush administration in terms of affirmative action? I know, Gary, you said affirmative action can't do it all. On the other hand, it is up there in the engine of the train in terms
Absolutely.
Of leadership. Where are we now in terms of the Bush administration? What kind of leadership can we expect? A relatively short answer.
I haven't seen much of any
okay.
yet.
All right.
It's one of the reasons I left.
Any agreement, disagreement there?
I agree with Dick totally. I think that there has been a lack of leadership on the part of Bush. At least you knew where Reagan was coming from. Bush, you can't tell. And there's a saying in the black community, I'd rather deal with a Southern Dixocrat racist than a Northern polite, covert racist. So, I mean, that's the kind of philosophy that I have towards Bush. So I think that, it depends on how he comes out on this 1990 Civil Rights Act that's up before them right now. But I have a feeling that he's going to go take the wimpy way out.
Generally speaking, I would tend to think that there's not a great deal of action on the administration's part. However, I think what's important to point out here is it doesn't frankly matter, because corporate America will do what is necessary, as they did in the Reagan administration, to ensure the fact that affirmative action work. And it goes back to what I said to you earlier, and that is it's going to be predicated on economy, on economics, and it's going to be predicated on competition.
This is my last question to each of you, and it speaks directly to that, Joe. You people, among other things you do in your lives, travel in the country and talk to people, as you have in Fairbanks, about what organizations, businesses, institutions like the University of Alaska Fairbanks, state government, can do to affect an affirmative action program. Can you give us a picture of your best advice, each of you, to whether it would be a private company or an institution? Can I start with you, Gary Cunningham?
I think that the key to affirmative action is to have the support of the top administration, not just lip service, but actually being committed to that plan. When you enter into an affirmative action plan, you're entering into an agreement between your employees and the public at large with regards to what actions that you're going to take. And I think the most common problem that we find is that people only play lip service to affirmative action, and then they find themselves later down the road in trouble because they didn't implement equal opportunity and or affirmative action policies. It's in their interests. It's for the purpose of ensuring that we have an equal and fair society. And I think that, whether it's the University of Alaska or the city of Anchorage or the city of Fairbanks or anywhere in the United States, that's the key to implementing an affirmative action program, from my perspective.
Dick Baldo, your thoughts?
Well, I certainly agree with Gary. I guess coming from the federal perspective, I think that companies or all institutions, organizations, should think of affirmative action as they would think of anything else. We have goals for our manufacturing section, for our marketing section. They all try and meet those. This human resources, which is what affirmative action is just another part of doing business.
And Joe Cooper.
I would say strong senior level support, mid-level management support, which is critical. And I basically agree with what's been said here. The bottom line is that affirmative action is good business. It frankly makes good sense. And again, it's just one of those things. It's the bottom line. If you want to stay alive, if you want to be competitive in a world that's becoming increasingly competitive, you're going to have to do what is necessary to make yourself stay alive, bottom line.
And are we going to successfully integrate the universities and the businesses of this country without a fight?
I don't think so. I think that it's always a struggle. Anything worth something is worth fighting for. And the history of this country has been a fight in terms of struggling for equality, struggling for justice. And that's just a part of the American process and the way that we do things, is that we struggle with one another. We struggle with one another philosophically, but we still are friends. We struggle with each other on political levels, et cetera, all trying to get to that point of justice and equality from whatever vantage point.
Democracy has to be fought for every day.
I'm not quite sure how that question was asked, but when you said integrate this country, or are you talking integrate companies?
I said universities and companies. That's what I meant.
Okay. In all fairness, there are a lot of universities and companies who are doing a fantastic job in terms of integration, and they have done a good job. And in some cases, it has been with a fight. In other cases, it will be a fight in the future. But the fact of the matter is that there are many companies who are doing a splendid job, and they will continue to do so. And that's one of the reasons why they are successful.
All right. On that note, I want to thank each of you gentlemen, and for people who have been listening but not quite sure which voice is which. The last voice you heard is Joe Cooper. He is the president of J. Cooper & Associates. Once again, that is a Washington-based consulting firm which specializes in equal employment opportunity and affirmative action trainings, as he has been doing in this city, among others. Dick Baldo has recently retired from the Federal Compliance Program in the U.S. Department of Labor. He is the former training coordinator and chief for the Planning and Support Section. And Gary Cunningham, deputy director of the Minnesota Department of Civil Rights. I want to thank each of you for stopping in today for an hour on your trip. Thank you, and farewell, and to the audience, have a good Sunday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What if I have a bad Sunday?